Okay.
But you know what? We didn't have time.
Yeah, and I couldn't think where we were or anything.
We got as far as the pre-strike period. And so what I want to concentrate on today is more on that pre-strike period, the organizing that went on in terms of the UAW federal locals,
mm-hmm.
and the role of the FP and the beginning relationships between the various people and the various groups.
Mm-hmm.
Then move into the strike, detail the strike, the formation of the brigade, the actions. And
just today, huh?
Yeah. And then carry it through to the end of the victory and the dissolving of the brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And next time we'll focus on the period following that and the World War II work.
I see. We couldn't skip that and go back to this period, could we? Because there are some figures that, you know, this is what I couldn't remember. I thought this was going to come up. Didn't we say we were going to try to do this one day or right after another? How did we say we were going to do it? I don't know why all of this left my mind.
Yeah,
I guess.
What I'd like to start with is what we ended with was in about 32, the Uniformed Socialist Party was
mm-hmm.
in office in the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to start with is more on your ideology, both of that being easier, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we go along in different time periods, since you're going to switch allegiance and join the SWP,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to trace the shift in your ideology. But one of the things I was specifically interested in was the fact
you want me to get into my political thinking then,
yeah.
too. All
because
right.
Particularly before the start, to see the way in which you viewed industrial unionism fitting in to the broader goal. Because certainly earlier,
mm-hmm.
the Socialist Party in the electoral process went basically through the electoral process the major changes would occur. And then there was a lot of difference in thinking and a lot of thinking that was no longer going to be the way it's going to happen. And through organizing the working class in industrial unions, particularly, is so. I wanted to sort of trace your thinking and the role. By this time, you had your socialist group and you had the study group, and you had developed a socialist consciousness. And
mm-hmm.
what the nature of that consciousness was, and how you saw bringing about
mm-hmm.
basic change, and where you saw as the UAW federal locals were beginning to organize and the fight that started going on with them.
See, there were a number of things that were happening throughout the nation that we had discussed in the current events part of our meetings, too. And I can't remember all of those things. I remember the rubber worker strikes, but there were several, you know, sporadic strikes breaking out and being quelled or getting a minor victory that really didn't affect. All right, we'll just do the best we can. I should just retire for 3 weeks and say nothing, but I can't right now. Nothing but just concentrating on this, and it would be a hell of a lot better than the way I'm doing it. All right. It'd be my own dissatisfaction, I guess. What do you want me to do?
Okay. Well, why don't we start with what, beginning with the formation of the Socialist Party group,
mm-hmm.
what was your ideology at that time period, and how did you see the beginning of the strikes elsewhere and the formation of the CIO and all this time into your own ideology?
Mm-hmm. Well, can I just talk?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. At the time that we first started the group and talking about socialist ideas, I think we were all pretty naive in many respects, but our primary interest in Flint was the history of the labor movement, and we went back to the Molly Maguires and studied their experiences in America and how some of their foreign ideas didn't quite relate to the American way of thinking and doing things. And then we would discuss in our present-day circumstance how would we have gone about it differently. Then we went through the Knights of Labor period and the old American Federation of Labor, the IWW, and the life of Joe Hill, and all of these people who made such a tremendous impact on our thinking then, because we were constantly with wage slaves, real wage slaves of General Motors, who were frightened to death of the corporation, frightened to death of losing their jobs, had no possibilities of moving their families out of the area. This is what a lot of young kids today don't understand. Why didn't you just get up and move if you didn't like it? But they didn't have enough money for the next meal many days, and there was no possibility, even if you were evicted and thrown out in the street, there was no money, no automobiles in many cases, or not enough money for gasoline, and to take your family anywhere. And they had no relatives. Most of them at that time came from the southern states. No relatives who could feed them perhaps more than one meal. And so we felt like we were just in a pit. There was nothing that we could do to get out of it except use our wits and do the best that we could. So the struggles, the early struggles, we gradually became accustomed to the necessity at that historical period for the violence that ensued. Because remember, the Socialist Party was a pacifist organization, and they believed in ballots, not bullets, and the whole orientation of the Socialist Party of America was along those lines. Eugene Victor Debs was probably the most outspoken labor representative of the Socialist Party, but at that time, Norman Thomas was primarily an author and an educator. And so we were getting accustomed to the whole idea of necessity forcing people to do certain things which they otherwise would not want to do or wouldn't consider an adequate measure of gaining their rights. But we could see that with such a dominant force in our lives as this huge corporation that had us trapped, that violence would probably become, by this time we didn't even say possibly, it was probably, that it probably would ensue. And at that time, we were reading in our current event discussions, each time we were reading about the various strikes that had broken out. The steel strikes were the most bitter and the most violent. And we learned that there was a Mohawk Valley formula that they had used. And we were, as the strike broke out, we were just in the process of becoming aware that they had plans, like an army, the corporation did, and it would be necessary for the workers to have plans. Now, we were just a tiny little advance group, a little advance guard of the working people. And so when it looked as though a few people were beginning to listen to only the ideas of unionism, we knew that gradually we would have to explain to them that this corporation is a violent corporation, the same as the steel corporation. This corporation is the largest industrial corporation in the world, and they're not going to put any interference with their profits. They have the power. We don't. The only way we can get at this is by sticking together, uniting, and getting more and more into our ranks. So, these were the classes that we held weekly, and little by little, I, like the others, were becoming accustomed to the idea, accepting the idea that we might have to face a battle, and I was teaching, now I began to teach others that this was the possibility.
But, you know, in other words, most of the reading and discussion was on unionism, rather than, for
instance,
did the study
group
read Marx and Engels?
Yes, we did have some of that, too. And Fourier. And, here again I'd have to remember back some of the revisionists that were against the ideas of Marx and Engels. And Plekhanov was one of the early writers in Russia that brought about the whole idea of a change in the basic change in the system. Yes, we did, but because we were so new to the ideas of socialism, this came very, very gradually. And there was a proletarian party group in the Penn Gallery building who had a teacher by the name of John Davies. John Davies never worked in the plant. He was an intellectual, an anarchist. And he was quite an incongruous person, except that he was a teacher, he was a Marxist. And he was a teacher of Marxism. Now, John Davies had a devoted band of followers, and we used to go to his lectures once a week. Our teachers would read Marx and Engels, but to get, you know, a man who had studied and who had devoted a lot of his life to teaching, reading and teaching this, we went to his classes once a week, the Proletarian Party classes. And John Davies was, like the whole proletarian party, sympathetic to the Communist Party of America and sympathetic to communism in Russia. Even at this time, let's see, this was in the period of the repressions, I think it was.
It was before the trials.
Before the trials, the periods of repressions and the period of Stalin's out-and-out dictatorship. This we could not accept as members of the Socialist Party. This he tried to justify, but he was more interested in the theory than he was in the Soviet Union, so we were able to go and listen. Now, at that point, he was rather pedantic, too. He would split hairs and ran on the meaning of a definition, one little part of a sentence, and surplus labor. We had to define that exactly, you know. And sometimes it got pretty doggone hard, and so there would be only a few of us, maybe three or four or five of us that would go. Others would say, oh, I can't take that. It's too damn dry. It's I'm going to blow away. I can't take it. So we got a certain amount of understanding, but at this period, because of our trying to build a socialist party, we did not have the time to sit down and delve into these things and become real students ourselves. And we possibly might have had to have someone other than John Davies, but in Flint, Michigan, in that year, he was a pretty big intellectual to us.
Now, when Roy Luther he was a member of the Socialist Party.
He was a member of the Socialist Party.
When he came in through the workers' education, what was the connection in between your Socialist Party group and what he was doing?
Our people that we were working on all went to his classes. And Roy Luther met with the Socialist Party group at our weekly meetings. I can't remember Roy going to John Davies' classes, but he may have, because he was around there a great deal of the time, and he knew those people well. And they respected him, and the Proletarian Party members went to his classes also. Roy was a tremendous influence as far as being an educator for the general ideas of workers' actions in the various unions in different periods. He was tremendous. And he was. He also took us further than we had gone in our Socialist Party meetings, because of the time element. He had a well-organized class that he went to, and this was another measure of our education. I don't remember the year that he came in. I think it was 1930. Was it? Uh-huh. I thought it was 32, but it was 34. Yeah, that's right. We organized around 32, a little before he came in. And Roy was a tremendous personality. He could win people over with a grin a mile wide. And he got a lot of people on the basis of his personality and educated them on the basis of his reasoning and his convictions. So he was really the Pied Piper of Flint, Michigan. That carried over from his having contact and establishing a number of people who respected him in the classes.
What influence do you think that he had helping
the Socialist Party to direct itself more towards the issue of unionism
in 34 when the locals were beginning to organize and talk about forming the international?
Oh, I think he had a big influence. Well, the whole Michigan Center, the whole Michigan organization was, the Socialist Party wasn't a well-knit group nationally. You'd have the farmers over in one state and Michigan was sort of an entity in itself, and I think that nationally they understood the problem, and Michigan had a great deal of influence on national decisions in their conventions. There's no question about that. Any political party proclaiming to be a socialist party would have to take cognizance of the great upheavals that were developing then in the nation, and Michigan did play a leading role. In the state of Michigan, the Detroit and Flint were the industrial centers. And we had a guy by the on the state executive committee, we had a guy by the name of Nahum Burnett from Charlotte, Michigan, yeah. And he was a farmer. And he used to get up there sometimes and say, and you know, Leonard Woodcock was a member of that, the state executive committee, and he was an accountant. And he thought that we were paying Pink a little too much attention at the time to solely the mechanics and the tactics of the labor movement, because he had not been involved at all. And he was quite a conservative. He was one of the most conservative elements on the state committee. Named Burnett from Charlotte was a farmer. And he used to get up there, "How about the farmers?" every time we'd get into an intense discussion on the proposals for the socialists entering into some of the current developments in the state of Michigan. "How about the farmers? You're not paying any attention to us." I can remember this and a couple of others, a couple of lawyers from Detroit who really didn't enter into the, but events were sort of taking them out of the mainstream anyway.
So it seems you, your group for yourself serve as the vanguard in terms of helping to carry the consciousness of the workers further in terms of the organizing and ferment that was going on.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. We knew that that would be our role, and we knew that it would be our role later on if there was a possibility of attacking GM at its center, Flint, Michigan. Now, we had a crazy concept. Who would be able to make the first move in Flint? And always we discounted Buick. That was the much easier work, and the people that were much more contented. They had to have those high-quality cars, and they let them have much more leeway. And AC was a group of that also was a question mark. So we decided it would have to boil down to Fisher 1 or Chevrolet. Fisher 2 we thought was too small, but as it happened, Fisher 2 sat down a few hours before Fisher 1. Fisher 2 just blew up. And I can't remember that leader's name there. He's an Irishman, I think. Anyway, it blew up, and they had a good group, a very good militant group over in Fisher 2. And in my opinion, now I believe that Fisher 1 went down because the Communist Party had three of the leaders out there, and they wanted to take the credit for initiating it. And we had these discussions going on constantly, and I was not aware that the Communist Party was having meetings up in the North End. The Communist Party met up there with the foreign-born elements, the people who had been born in other countries and then came there. They were mainly Buick workers, but they had some that had arrived 2 years before in Fisher 1. And I was not aware until I heard Bob Travis's talk one time that they said they were meeting in cellars and basements, and this is where we had to meet too, you know, when it got very, very tough. When the men started putting buttons on and getting their heads knocked off, being met in beer gardens after work by people who said, "We're going to teach you to keep your mouth shut," and then give them a beating up. Then we couldn't meet in beer gardens or anywhere and just talk to people.
But how would you get them? Were these things the people who'd already been converted and were activists that were meeting, or were you still able to reach out to new people? Or was that done by those who'd been converted in the factory itself?
That were in the factory primarily. And then they would invite, they would say just a few words and find out that a man also was itching to say something. But because they had lip readers in the factory just prior to the strike, you know, they would say, "Well, let's go have a beer somewhere." And they would sit down and over the hum and the noise of a beer garden. And you can't imagine what a beer garden's like unless you've been around a working factory, a working area around a factory, where it's all talk and noise and sometimes a jukebox going in the rear. They would be able to then have discussions. And even then they had to test each other because there were many stool pigeons who would get you to say as much as possible and go back and report it, and then you woke up beaten up, you know, picking yourself up off the street or something. And this is when we got down to any serious discussions about the CIO and the information that came from the miners of the amalgamated in New York. We had to then meet in homes, in basements, and have it in different places all the time. You know, in the beginning it sounded very weak and very small, but the people that we felt that we could trust very often in a plant four group would be 10 or 12 people in somebody's home, maybe 7 or 8 and maybe you expected 15, and people would just become frightened at the last minute. And a group from Plant 8, you know. Well, then we would, when we were meeting with these groups, we would say, you know, we had a large group from Plant 4. Oh, you mean the guys over there are getting started? Plant 6 and so on.
So it was each meeting was plant by plant.
Yes, until later, then naturally some of the Plant 6 guys would come over to a 4 meeting, and then finally got little groups where the key people from each plant, because it is dangerous meeting in these places.
Now, you know, when you say we, you mean social
party? I mean, now let's see, who do I mean in the Socialist Party? We had some members in the Socialist Party who just couldn't keep up with this sort of thing. For instance, Grover English, a very fine man, and his wife, Blanche English, he was a Buick worker, and he couldn't understand the urgency of all this. And it was, he knew that something had to be done. He understood intellectually. He was not involved in all these meetings, but he would support us in a Socialist Party meeting if we made a motion, this should be done or that should be done. And there, again, we had, this was pretty exclusive at this point. We didn't just let anybody come into an SP meeting at that point. He was supported, and there were a few others. Oh, and at this time, this is something that hampered us quite a bit. We were having a discussion, a theoretical difference, with one group within the Socialist Party who later joined the Lodestonites, the Communist Party opposition group. And when we had the split, they took about one-third of the membership of our Socialist Party, which was hard. But at the same time, it eliminated an awful lot of discussion, you know, when factional fight prior to a split is a devastating thing on your energies. You'll be in a meeting and it'll go until 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning to settle some damn little split hair point.
Were they opposed?
No, they were not opposed. In fact, they were some of the finest people as far as militancy was concerned, but they were darn short on theory.
Mm-hmm.
And they were adventuristic, and at the time they had an organizer coming in from Detroit by the name of Strawn. I think it was Stuart Strawn. There were two Strawn brothers. And Strawn would meet with them separately and give them all the arguments, and they would come up and give us the arguments. We considered it rather adventuristic. They wanted to show that they were super militant, more militant than the Communist Party, and that seemed to be their chief aim, to show up the Communist Party, and they were truly anti-communist all the way down the line, not only what was happening in the Soviet Union, but they were out to every little thing. All right. So this factional fight was going on for a while, and I can remember when the split came, they came in, and what did they take? They took the piano, I don't know, and so it's a certain number of the chairs, and we had so few things then to even hold a meeting, you know, these were essential items, these chairs and one table or whatever it was, but when we were freed from that also, and we thought it was important to try to convince them up until a certain point, and then we knew that, you know, you have to go forward, you can't just stay and argue about how you're going forward.
And at the same time, though, the Communist Party was also holding meetings.
Yes, they were, but we had no contact with them. They had nobody, they had one person in Chevrolet at the time, and they were working on another Indian fellow by the name of Clive Mayo, who was a lovely guy, but unable to speak. They had no leadership, nobody that was doing anything in Chevrolet that we knew of. Now, they did have, they had groups out in Fisher Body. Joe Devitt and Walter, can't think of his name right now. God, he was the brightest of all of them, and he was a very nice guy. He wasn't a bitter, you know, a Communist Party member was one that was for cutting you down, no matter if you were at the leadership of a picket line. He would just as soon cut your leadership, cut you right out of the picture, because it was one of these terrible things that the Communist Party felt they had to have the leadership, and if they were going to have a revolution, they were going to be the head of the revolution. Some of them were very unforgiving if you were not with them. And I had been asked more than once to join.
Well, what was the, the relationship between, for instance, when the Mortimer came in and when he was replaced by Travis before the strike, what was the relationship between, like, the core group that you were trying to build and...
Wyndham Mortimer never met with any of the people in Chevrolet. Never. Now, we met with him a little before the strike through Walter, through... Roy Ruther, Walter Ruther coming up from Detroit, and Victor, and George Edwards, and let's see, who some of the others were after at the time. We met a couple of times, but we had no contact with him, and apparently this policy of the Communist Party, he didn't want to have contact with us. He felt, or maybe he felt, he was an honest guy and a decent guy. Maybe he felt that the Communist Party had organized the key group there. And I know they did not trust the socialists. I know that. For instance, in the old AFL union, Auto Workers Union, Federal Union, my father-in-law, Carl Johnson, was one of these Norwegians that were dogged. I'm going to stay in there. And he was not able to control the decisions. But he always said to Kermit, you should go, you've got to maintain a nucleus. This is the history of the labor movement. We've got to say that we are the inheritors and so on. Now, when there were stool pigeons in there, and it was impossible to do anything through that body. And Carl Johnson knew that, too. But perhaps they thought because he did go so regularly, and Kermit used to go also, and I used to go up and just... listen, it was a very dry thing, and they didn't want any discussion of any meaningful issues. Perhaps they thought because he was so regular in his attendance, he might have been one of the stool pigeons. And the Communist Party thought that anybody who wasn't a member of the Communist Party were all stool pigeons anyway. So perhaps Wyndham Mortimer didn't know. But Wyndham Mortimer did not meet with us, except with when Roy Ruther was in on a couple of meetings. And those are rather hazy in my mind, those meetings with Wyndham Mortimer.
Was any woman involved in these meetings with both the members of the individual plan and then with, for instance, these meetings with Lutheran?
No. Geraldine Clacy, before we had the split, she left with the Lovester Knights. Geraldine Clacy and Hester LeDuc were active also. And
were their husbands auto workers?
Oh yes. And their husbands were in Plant 9, that plant, and they led that business where they took the bloody beating.
Mm-hmm.
And these were unusual women, very unusual women, and they did get sidetracked by the Loves Tonight business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that both of them would have, well, they both were in the auxiliary and the brigade. But by this time, they were reduced to sort of a carping role on the sidelines. Well, Genora isn't everything, you know. She's an SP member, but she's not everything. And don't trust her. She's a Communist Party member. And they were reduced. Their effectiveness was reduced. It was, as I look at it now, I can see it was a sad thing. And then I kept thinking, oh, my God, get those nuisances out of the way, you know. Because they're not, as women came up and didn't understand anything, we were just trying to tell them about unionism. These women who were capable of telling them so much about the history of labor were reduced to a sad little state. They did do some good, and I'm not going to try to take anything away from them because they were unusual.
But in the pre-sit-down organizing, there were the three of you, were the three women who would be involved in these front meetings.
Yes. I would say that Geraldine Clacy went up there more than Hester LeDuc or even I think. I don't remember how often she went. It was not a meeting where we were invited or wanted or desired. We practically had to sit in the back of the room, only members, you know, and it was such a, I don't know if, I think Sidney Fine Beals were some of the ways, some of the topics that they would take to deflect the workers from the main questions of the day. They were dry.
So then both Kermit and Carl Johnson were involved in the federal local?
Yes.
And then did they become involved in the progressive caucus that finally led to the formation of the International and then taking it into the CIO? Were you involved in that struggle then?
Of course. Of course they were, both of them. They were leaders of that. And Kermit became the strike leader of Plant 4 Chevrolet. His father was a very, very influential figure, and he was more the intellectual educator.
Now, I mean, before the strike, though, when they finally convinced the AFL at the convention to give the charter them as an international, and then, and after that is when first Mortimer came in and then Travis came in as the organizer
Of course they were. But we didn't have any direct connection with the international, with the newly elected international people in Detroit, except as Wyndham Mortimer came up, or we agreed about them, or one of our persons would go down on some kind of a committee down to Detroit. And most of that we left up to Roy Rooster, an awful lot of it we did, because Walter and Victor were down there in Detroit, and they knew intimately what was going on. So that's why Roy was between Detroit and Flint, and we had no need for, you know, he was our delegate bringing us the information.
He was the liaison.
He was the liaison person,
And then,
his
identification was with the Socialist Party, probably gave you more strength and leverage, even though
the
organizers were Communist Party people.
Oh, of course. Of course. And then later, I think Travis became aware of the fact that he needed Roy up to Flint. And in his speeches, he says, I then hired Roy. then Roy came in as his assistant. And while Travis had the title, Roy was the Pied Piper. Travis was not a speaker in meetings. He was good on organizational questions, very good. He just came up from, I think it was Autolite in Toledo, if I'm not mistaken. And his wife at that time had cancer of the breast, his first wife. He was young and he was energetic, and I think the Communist Party just signed him up, or just in the process. I think he did it out of his respect for Wyndham Mortimer, who came out of White Motors in Cleveland. And Wyndham Mortimer had played quite a role. It was a smaller corporation, and the tactics were nothing like GM. But for that period, it was a little victorious figure that came out of that, and he had respect for him, and then they used those tactics to consult it, and Travis had great confidence in Linda Mortimer. And so I think he must have just joined the Communist Party, but he wasn't having a hardened factionalist by the time. He would work with everybody, but he was controlled. They sent in party organizers to control him and surround him, And they say they took the finances over without anybody else seeing it. But it was very significant that the woman who did take it over was a Communist Party member from New York, Lou Smith. And the Krauses were in there, of course. And he was surrounded, and all of his secretaries, everybody, by members outside people coming in from the Communist Party and taking domination of the headquarters.
Did they effectively try and isolate the Socialist Party?
Yes.
Because of Victor's position, this was not possible.
It wasn't possible to do it, but they did try at every point. For instance, they knew who I was when I went up and said, what can I do to help the strike? They said, the kitchen, go out in the kitchen, because Fisher One was down, and they had the wife of Bud Simons and the wife of Joe Devitt organizing a kitchen out there. And this I objected to. And in the first place, I was nowhere near Fisher Body One. And I felt that I was a part of the Penn Gully, the central headquarters location. And so then they said that I could set up a press clipping bureau, which sounded like it was something that was needed. And I went in, and I, of all the papers that were being brought in, sent in to the bureau, I started clipping the articles pertaining to the UAW, particularly in Michigan specifically, but generally, no, nationally too. There was the national and the state, yeah. And when I found out that all of these pastings that I were making, all these clippings and pastings and sheets, that was supposed to be able to direct the organizer, and this was before Roy came in, I think. I'm not sure if Roy was in there or not at that point. Direct him, you know, and penciling out sections for him to read. And I found out that they were going through Dorothy Krauss, And she was showing him what she wanted, she thought was pertinent, what he should see. And I thought, well, then any idiot can do my role. And I think it was 2 or 3 days, and I told them as much. You know, anybody can do this.
He also thought this was while the pre-strike organizing was going on. So this is once you sit down
and begin. Yeah.
Now, it sounds like the Social Party and its sort of core group of people was meeting with the men in different plants beforehand.
Yes, but this was our force was primarily in Chevrolet. We had one or two from Fisher Body One, and one or two from Buick. We had the president of the Transport Workers Union, which had a strike at the simultaneous, yeah, already on strike with ours, Fred Stevens, and I can't think of. Well, right now I can't think, but it was primarily all Chevrolet workers, the ones that we had. Even before the split, these were all Chevrolet workers that split away from us, too.
Well, that this is a jumping ahead, this question.
All right.
But, one of my questions in reading all the background was, well, since Chevrolet 4 was so strategic,
mm-hmm.
why was it that it was not till the very end and was the turning point? Why was it that Chevrolet 4 in the very beginning when Fisher 1 and 2 went down, that Chevrolet 4 didn't go down then? Now, what I hear you saying makes me think that it might be because of the factional split between the CP organizers and the SP, basically.
No, that had nothing. Well, wait a minute, between the SP and the CP?
Mm-hmm.
They wanted, yes, now wait a minute. In the first place, that was an easier plant to shut down, Fisher 1. And Chevrolet, you know, I had 10 plants, all huge things. All interrelated with a guard system. They had more protection there than anywhere else. Fisher One plants had 2 units, a north unit and a south unit. And they shut down in the north unit and completely shut off all when they went on strike, all the south units. They didn't even try to barricade or sit down in that. They only sat down in one plant facing on Saginaw Street, which made it very easy for us to have picket lines and demonstrations, and anything was obvious. Anything that you did to the men in that plant, it was very obvious to the whole city of Flint. Chevrolet went way back with only a main gate getting on the front, and it was all behind big fences, the whole compound of Chevrolet. That was a difficult thing, and it was so spread out in such a huge area. So it was much easier to shut down a single unit like Fisher One. Than it would be any part of Chevrolet, and 4 was the strategic plant. Now, plant four already employed more workers than Fisher 1 and 2 put together, you see, so it was easier.
I just was curious. I didn't
no.
But the fact that your group had organized, seemed to have this core group among, and we did most of the work among the Chevrolet workers.
Mm-hmm.
And the CP seemed to have a core group in Fisher.
Mm-hmm. With the Proletarian Party. I think the main, yes, I know, the main leaders of the Proletarian Party were also in Fisher 1.
Mm-hmm.
They could not have done anything in Fisher 1 without the Proletarian Party.
Mm-hmm.
Not absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And on their strike committee, where they say we control the strike committee or we were the strike committee, it was 3 and 3. 3 Proletarian Party leaders and 3 Communist Party people. We're on the strike committee at Fisher One out there. And I believe that, naturally, I know, that the Proletarian Party people would have been in that orbit of Fisher One plans and meetings and so on.
Well, when the sit-down actually came at 2 and then 1, were you taking vice pods or did you think it was going to happen that way?
Were we taken by surprise? No, there was too much pre-discussion among the people at the center, you know, that Fisher 1 was hot, and it was well-organized, and our information came from one of the brightest Proletarian Party members. You know, this is a peculiar thing. The reason that the Communist Party could take credit for that, too, is that the Proletarian Party had the same position at that time that the SLP had. And we had a few SLPers a meeting in a little group in Flint, too. And that was that the unions were the labor lieutenants of capitalism. And it didn't matter a damn bit. And of course, the revolution, you know, who led the union movement, they were to be the educators, and they had to carry it a step further than just economic organization. And so Clayton Carpenter, who was probably the brains of the proletarian party and as far as tactical application was concerned, did not play any role except advisor role in that plan. And his people, Victor Vanetten and Jay Green and another one, I can't think of his name, were on the strike committee. When it came to time to elect the officers of that local for the first time, Clayton Carpenter didn't run the first time. Then he became financial secretary. He got all involved in thinking, well, this is where you really come in contact with workers. But he could have been the president of that local had he wanted to the first time.
Information was, you were getting information from the
Proletarian
Party people.
Yes.
Was there a link to what was happening in
Houston
before the strike?
Yes, Clayton Carpenter especially. He was very close to us. And he was not a bitter factionalist. He had great respect for Carl Johnson and for Kermit Johnson. Very close friendship and cooperation. And also Jay Green and Victor Vanetten. But as I said, the Proletarian Party line was for defense of the Communist Party in America and in the Soviet Union. The Socialist Party did not have that faith nor confidence in anything that they had done, either on the scale of the national action or nationally, naturally in the Soviet Union. So, now where are we?
Now we're at the beginning of the sit-down.
No, it didn't take us by surprise. We knew that they were looking for a pretext, and that was the attitude that all of us had. They'll find a pretext, and it'll be easier, you know, out there and fish their body. And the pretext was that the company had made a few moves, and they charged them with going to take the dyes out of the plant. Now, the dyes are the big things that you put in the presses, you know, to stamp out the parts. Mm-hmm. And it's like having a pattern. If you ship that somewhere else, you're not going to manufacture those body parts there. It's going to another body plant. So naturally, that was the biggest threat in the world. Now, I don't know if the company, this is not in the book, I don't know if the company actually had moved any of the essential dyes or not. Mm-hmm. But this was enough to let all the Fisher body workers know that our jobs are being taken away from us. Mm-hmm. That was the, you know, the red flag to the Fisher body workers. Taking the dyes out, they're taking our jobs away. And it was much easier out there to transmit that immediately, telegraph that to the workers. And so when they shut down, they had their plans well organized because it was much easier. And if you remember reading anything about the strike, they had the upholstery division there where they could make beds, most comfortable existence, and had access because of this long frontage on Saginaw. The workers could go right up and pass things over, food and radios and all kinds of things for their comfort, books. They had libraries in there. I made a tour of it, too, the inspection, and all the dignitaries, you know, from British labor movement and from the Eastern Amalgamated and International Ladies General. They all went through there and toured the plant. And we were a little worried at one point that everybody was going to think, you know, they're having too easy a life.
Well, you know, since you're working with the Daniel Chevrolet people, and since it seemed that the Proletarian Party, the Communist Party, were the ones who were running the show at Fisher, how did you see being able to fit into the strike? Did you think there would be a problem that you would be willing gladly accepted as would anybody else who came in to support it?
Oh, I was quite sure I wouldn't be gladly accepted by the Communist Party at any stage of the game. And that was made quite apparent as soon as the Krauses arrived, you know, because they knew my influence, even at that point. They knew Kermit, and they knew Carl Johnson's influence. And the three of us were very often together. And they knew that I was born and raised in the city. They didn't have one member of their party that was born and raised in Flint, you know. And I was, you know, I was told, go to the kitchen like anybody else. And where I should have been, said, they should have said to me, stay here at the center of it.